Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Monday. Eclipse day. And of course, we are so close to like the perfect eclipse that someone was telling me that they were looking at the highway going up to northern Vermont, northern Maine, and northern New Hampshire. It was bumper to bumper on Sunday. Thousands are showing up. But I'm not going to talk about the eclipse as I open my show. I am going to talk about a funeral I attended on Sunday, and it was emotional, remarkable, and I have to tell you that Art Ellison was my first boss in 1980. I had graduated from law school. I realized I didn't want to practice law. It was an economic downturn. There were no jobs, and the only job I could get was to be the adult tutorial coordinator for Grafton County, which meant that I was educating undereducated adults, giving them GEDs, getting them high school diplomas, and teaching them how to read, and he was my first boss. How many years later, he always had my back. He helped me when I ran for governor. He helped me when I ran for Congress. He served on the board of my little radio station. But for 38 years, he was the director of adult education. He understood the connection not only between learning, but also that if you don't have food in your belly, it's harder to learn. And so when he left adult education, literally hours after he retired, he decided to run for the New Hampshire legislature and spent the last three terms trying to make sure that there was access to food, especially for kids in public schools. We're surrounded by states where every single child gets a free lunch. New Hampshire, which is one of the richest states in the nation, you have to be at 135% of poverty to get a free lunch. And his last words before he died was, just feed the damn kids. Anyway, but I want to read to you what I wrote after attending his service or funeral or celebration, because I needed it and I didn't realize how much I needed it. And I wrote the following. I do not believe in heaven, but I do believe that we have an obligation to make our heaven here. Today I attended one of the most inspirational, remarkable, funny, tender celebrations of life. It was for Art Ellison, a man whose very being personified public service, his commitment to the underserved, the underfed, the undereducated, the too often unseen. As I looked around the packed room at the Groponi Center in Concord, New Hampshire, I realized I was just seeing a tiny slice of the heaven that Art had made. As I was leaving the event with tears rolling down my cheeks, I understood that his death was not about ending, but a renewed invitation to fight on. The packed room was about triumph. It was about winning. It was about success and touching lives and making a difference. How lucky am I? My first boss, Art Ellison, he never left my side. Anyway, back in 2018, I get this call about this guy, and he's like, he's thinking of running for Congress, and someone said, you know, he should really be on your radio show. And I'm like, all right, you know, who is he? And little did I know that in 2024, this young man who thought about running for Congress in 2018 would end up being the author of a book entitled Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. His name is Austin Friedrich. And Austin, my favorite review of your book is from Booklist, all right? And it says, Friedrich dissects not only the food barons' businesses practices, but also the disastrous impacts of these practices. The author, who frequently sounds as though he is fighting to control his personal rage as the people he's writing about, backs up his statements with facts and figures. This is an angry and accusatory book, but also a fair and well-documented one. That is a very, very cool compliment, Austin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Arnie. That review always, that one made me laugh because it's such a weird, it comes off to me as a little backhanded.
It's powerful. And let me tell you why I love the backhanded sort of embrace and slap and in a way, yeah, acknowledgement of what you've done. And you may remember this. I think I may have told you the story years ago when I was running for governor. The day before the election, my brother calls me up and says, go grab the Wall Street Journal. I'm going, the Wall Street Journal. This is the day, 1992. Yeah. I'm like, I don't read the Wall Street Journal. He goes, just buy the Wall Street Journal and turn to the editorial page. And I went, the editorial page? I brought my fish in the editorial page. And so we open up the Wall Street Journal the day before the 92 election. And they have this little editorial called The Aside. And The Aside said, The Nation magazine has picked 12 people they want to see win in America tomorrow. Barbara Boxer, Carol Moseley Braun, Russ Feingold. You can just imagine what the 12 were. Well, we've looked around America, and there's only one liberal we want to see win. That in-your-face feminist taxer, Arnie Arneson. She has more guts than all of them.
So did that you frame, backhand, you had, did you frame it?
I got to find it again.
You got to find it.
I know, but I should embroider it on a pillow. But that's why I loved Booklist. I love their sort of backhanded slap, because you are angry. And you're legitimately angry. But let everyone understand why you are angry, Austin. Explain to everyone who you are, where you come from, what you have seen, both from the perspective of how you were raised, from the location in which you live, and also from the politics that you dabbled in for a while, which I think to a large extent was also part of the inspiration for you to realize, I've got to figure out how to tell the story because I have to make change. And if it isn't through the elective process, it's going to be through another process. And I think that is in part the result of this book, Barron's. So introduce yourself to my audience. I know Austin, but they do not.
Yeah, so everyone, I'm a seventh generation Iowan. First, my family go to college, and I studied the concentration of the food system. Like Arnie said, you know, I ran for Congress, but I kind of did everything wrong, but in the best way possible, where instead of telemarketing all day, I just went out and talked to people. And so much of those conversations shaped this book of, I mean, it's these one-on-ones with people and talking to small town newspaper people where you realize that's where you see the real undercurrent of America. Is this whole book started because of a dive bar conversation in Des Moines, Iowa, in that campaign where, and I didn't realize this at the time, Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits. So this operative was, or a Republican operative, keep in mind, was complaining to me that how the largest donor in Iowa was this hog farmer, and how he had one home by the gated, in the gate, only gated community in Iowa, another home down in Naples, Florida, flew back and forth on a private jet, and allegedly on it were the words, "When pigs fly."
The title of his privately owned jet had "When Pigs Fly." That's the story.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, Arnie, I love this for two reasons. Number one, first of all, that's good copy.
Yes.
And number two, what a powerful symbol of what happened to Iowa in my lifetime, that the largest political donor in Iowa is one man that does 5 million hogs. And also, in a campaign, you just do so much driving, and you drive the countryside, and the Iowa countryside doesn't feel like the countryside anymore. It feels like the New Jersey Turnpike. The animals are gone. The land is incredibly industrial, and it's just dead. And so to me, I wrote this article originally in Vox of what happened to Iowa, because there's this whole notion of efficiency, but you really realize it was a regulatory capture of the system by the business elite. And then what I realized after publishing this article was, oh, this is the story across the food system. So I have 7 barons in my book, and each baron is telling a bigger structural story of how things went off the rails during the second Gilded Age.
I love how you get inspired to tell the story. And I love that you were raised in Iowa and that you ended up, because of politics, talking to people. And, you know, it's really interesting. My parents, we were talking about the Farm Bill, because every 5 years the Farm Bill is renewed. And when people think of the Farm Bill, what they think about is some guy driving a farm old tractor. That's what they think about. Okay. They have this image of the farm. And I think what's so important about Barron's is that it comes out just as we're in the process of trying to renew the Farm Bill. And to a large extent, the Farm Bill isn't a farm bill. It's a Wall Street bill. It's not a farm bill, everyone. It's a Wall Street bill. And what we don't get, and I posted one of the statistics from your article and from your book, and I posted this, and you wrote, in 1980, if you go look back at 1980 and you look at the cost of food for fresh vegetables and fresh fruit, the cost has increased by 40%. If you look at the cost of processed food, the cost of processed food has decreased by 40%. And then you point out, and what do we know about processed food? Bingo, obesity. What do we know about processed food? Empty calories. What do we know about processed food? If you're poor, what can you afford? Not what you need, which is the fresh fruit and vegetables, but what you can afford, which is the processed food that you were talking about. So how did this happen? If you're talking about 1980 seeing this dramatic increase in beets and corn and fruits and vegetables, and this decrease, What did we do? What changed? What opened the door that not only led to these barons that you describe in your book, and there are more than just the seven that you describe about, but who do I, what finger do I point to blame? And how do we begin to understand that it's not only bad for Iowa, it's not only bad for people in their food affordability, but in the end, it's bad for the climate and it's bad for our future.
Let me step back and just say, the goal of my book is really talking about not just agriculture, but the food system. One in 10 Americans work in the food system. Like, you're totally right. I mean, I call the Farm Bill now the Wall Street Farm Bill. It's designed for only Wall Street at the expense of everyone else. And I really use my Grain Baron chapter to tell that story where, I mean, when I first put this book together, Arnie, I didn't plan to write about Cargill. People don't realize Cargill is actually the largest private company in America. They're bigger than the Koch brothers. I really do think Cargill is the closest thing we have to a modern day Standard Oil. They're all about owning the pipelines, the middle, about transporting grain. They're still in Russia. They're not consumer facing. So you don't know who they are, but they, you know, most of the food you eat now, they had some role in it. And so I use their story to talk about the Farm Bill, where like the original Farm Bill comes out of the Dust Bowl. And it's basically a Goldilocks thing where you want to produce just enough, but not too much. So you'll get subsidies, but you have to take land out of production. And there's also a cap. Cargill hated this from the get-go. I read their incredibly boring 1,600-page history. And, you know, they hated FDR. They filed lawsuits against it because they want to move as much grain as possible. They do not want to limit production. So what you see is a systematic assault on the Farm Bill to what I focus on the 1996 one, where it really went off the rails. Where now the Farm Bill is designed to overproduce grains at the expense of everything else. So like you, when people hear crop insurance, they think it's for rainy days. No, it's basically a price guarantee. So prices get low, it kicks in, and 60% of your premium is paid by us. So for example, and there's no limit on it. So like Bill Gates owns one of the most farmlands in America. So if he wants to grow corn, there's no limit to how much crop insurance he wants to get. The thing about this system though, it's picking winners and losers. And like you said, because it's all about doing processed food and industrial animal feed for the animals in confinements. And so it takes money to be healthy now in America. I mean, to me, the obesity crisis is rooted in like this have-have-notness. And that is the system crowds out everything else. Like, it's so simple, but what really got me going on this was all the apple orchards I grew up with are gone now. And it's not like they were plowed under for subdivisions. It's just that, they became cornfields.
You mentioned that it went off the rails in 1996. And you mentioned Cargill. And of course, I think I may have told you back in 2018, my roommate's father was the vice president of Cargill. So I've been aware. No, trust me, honey bun. I've been aware of Cargill. Like, and nobody knows. It is probably the largest corporation in the world. But we don't know because it's privately held. You know, and then when you recognize this connection to the food system, you go crazy. And then when you tell your story at the very beginning about what sort of inspired this book in 2018 was about this hog farmer being able to like cut a check for $300,000 for eventually who would become Governor Reynolds, who's the most toxic governor I think Iowa's ever had. But anyway, so he got a reward on his investment with that $300,000. But what I think is really important is to understand that, you know, Cargill could have filed lawsuits. Cargill may have hated, you know, what happened in the past, but what ultimately happened is that we now equate money with speech. And if we equate money with speech, and Cargill is the richest corporation probably in the world that we don't know anything about, imagine what they've been able to buy and sell. And they're not able to buy and sell just Republicans. They're buying and selling Democrats. I mean, I think about your former Democratic governor, who I think was in the pocket of people like Cargill. And so people don't understand that. So it's not only that these bills are good because they're not farm bills, they're Wall Street bills, but they're good for the Cargills and the ConAgs and these huge corporations that now control the entire food system. And they don't care about food any more than health insurance really cares about health. What they care about ultimately is profit. And then guess what? The rest of us are expendable and we're paying to die. That's the part. We're paying to be obese. I mean, that's the shocking part of this story about barons is that it comes at so many costs.
Yes. And that's, to me, the additional layer scare. What's scary with Cargill is they're incredibly effective at using middlemen and hiding what they're doing. Is think about Koch brothers, they would cut a check, you hear about them. Cargill always has someone else do their bidding. It's incredibly Machiavellian. And it's weird to say this, but it's incredibly smart too, because we just don't realize their power. But the one thing I really want your audience to take away is industry will love to say that this food is cheap. And I actually believed it until I actually dived into the data about a year ago. And that's just not factually true. When markets are concentrated, of course, they're going to gouge. Dollar for dollar, most Western democracies spend less on food than we do. And we're about even with Italy. And so we're paying for it. We're paying more for junk. That's essentially what you look at the grocery store now, and especially in the meat area, it's just rampant gouging. Like if there's one graph I could include in my book, it's beef, or what you're paying in the store has done this, keeps going up and up, but the rancher get has essentially been flat. And that is just monopolies doing monopoly things.
Well, but the other thing is that if we have monopolies and we don't have farmers anymore. You mentioned about what is emptied out in Iowa. There are no farmers anymore. So again, part of the problem is if we're talking about resentment, if we're talking about what's happened in the food belt, and you look at all these things, the farmers don't own their land. They
No.
don't own their tractors. They're, as you point, they're almost serfs. You know, they're working for the man. They're not working for themselves anymore. I was supposed to do an interview with a guy who wrote a book about how rural America and the angry rural America is now controlling our politics. Well, they are angry, but isn't it interesting who they're angry at? They're not angry at Cargill. They're not angry. They're angry in the wrong places, and Trump becomes their cult leader as if he isn't going to even cultivate even more the kind of monopolies you write about.
So I'm so glad you said that because I increasingly view a lot of rural America as like an extraction colony. It's producing
Yes.
the most wealth it's ever produced, but none of that wealth is staying there. So we should not be shocked that the politics of resentment has filled that void. And the thing about it is, we've seen what the big tech has done to media organizations in America. It took all the ad revenue and it's not sharing it. And so especially in these communities, the news ecosystem is so captured. So it's almost like people just don't know what's going on. I mean, that's my whole goal of my book is to tap into the anger and redirect it. Because blaming immigrants is tale as old as time. But the problem here really is these extractive companies.
But in Iowa, the one thing, I mean, we are we're we talk to Ryan Melton a lot. Ryan Melton is running for Congress in your
Yeah.
state. And I mean, when you think about it, but how do you not notice when you see the toxicity pouring into your rivers? How do you not notice when you see what's happening to the landscape? How do you not notice? And how do you not figure out, because it becomes so obvious, who to blame, because you know that your farm didn't do it. That wasn't your vision, but it is, again, the man that is controlling the hog farms, the man that is controlling the growing of the grain. Why do you have to write a book, and why didn't they take notice and then use their power to make the change?
Because hear me out on this one.
All
I actually
right.
put a lot of the blame on Secretary Vilsack, Biden's USDA secretary. People need to understand in a lot of these communities, there's a sense of defeatism and Stockholm syndrome. People fought power and they lost.
What do you mean they
It's
fought power and they lost? How did they fight power? When did
so
they do it and when did I miss it?
I focus a lot on my hog chapter of how this happened. And the big pivotal moment in Iowa was the 2002 governor campaign. Vilsack was running for re-election and he was running against the head lobbyist for my hog baron. And one of the defining issues were these hog confinements. Because imagine, like, your home is your everything in America, it's your wealth. One of these things come up to you and it just destroys your home value. You had a real rebellion in Iowa, small towns with gyms being full, people demanding something. They're organizing for Vilsack. Vilsack ran TV ads on this. And the way Iowa works is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of confinements. After he won, Vilsack oversaw the largest confinement boom in Iowa history. That breaks
But
people.
what was his marketing pitch when he ran? And then what did he do after he ran? I mean, I don't like Vilsack for exactly the same reason. I'm kind of aware of what you're telling me. And of course, now look where Vilsack is. He's in the Biden administration. It's not like rot disappears, rot gets moved up the food chain. Was it a bait and switch? Who paid for him? And why is he always in this sort of like protective cone where almost every administration grabs Vilsack and brings him in? And yet what you're describing is what he did that was so destructive to Iowa.
You think of him like Harold Hill in The Music Man. He'll tell you what you want to hear, but he doesn't mean a single word of it. Look how much rhetoric and press releases he's done in the last 4 years over the meat markets. The meat markets factually have gotten more concentrated the last 4 years. Like Walmart is making an aggressive play to beef right now. Like that's how bad it is. And so what he did in that campaign was saying, I'm going to stop these confinements. I'm going to do something about it. And then he did the opposite. And what it is, it just destroys the activists. And on top of it, you've had administrations both sides of the aisle for the last few decades saying they're going to do something and no one does anything. So your work, you can talk this rhetoric in Iowa, no one's going to believe you. I'm sorry. I've been in these rooms. There's a hopelessness. And so That's my frustration right now with him is there's no bigger bipartisan pinata in America than tackling the meat monopolies. I mean, they're employing children. We are back in the era of the jungle, but he hasn't done anything. That's where my anger comes out is Earl Butz, Secretary, President Nixon, Secretary of Agriculture, never pretend to be a friend of the farmer. He said, literally, get out. Vilsack, there's nothing worse for people than when someone pretends to have your back and they stab you behind the back. And that's what I mean is like, it's really easy to blame people for their situations. But then I think being in these communities enough, you feel the brokenness and like you don't, you understand there's raw anger. There's raw anger that doesn't know how to be channeled. And on top of it, in Iowa, you have Big Ag is just financing the ecosystem of the news. So it's almost like to the point where imagine living in West Virginia in the 19th century and all your news is coming from the coal industry. That's effectively what we have now in a lot of these rural communities.
But it's so much bigger than Iowa, and I know I because it is the food system. We're talking about these huge monopolies that control everything. We keep, and one of the things that we sort of admire about the Biden administration is that he's talking about busting these monopolies, busting these. But I'm just trying to figure out where is he focusing, and is he focusing on what you've just described in your book with these barons?
I'm so glad you brought that up because to me, in monopolies, you see one of Biden's best appointments and one of his worst. Vilsack is one of his worst. But one of his best is that commission, young woman, Lina Khan, because
Lina
she's
Khan.
filing all these anti-monopoly charges. The problem is she can police all these markets in America except meatpacking. The USDA has a carve-out for that. So that's why I argue at the end of my book is we should take that antitrust authority away from USDA and give it to her. Because it's so clear by every metric, USDA has failed farmers, workers, eaters. It's basically just a propaganda apparatus for Big Ag.
The USDA has carved out meat from monopoly? Oh my God. I
No,
mean, this is, well, now explain that to me. Go, repeat this so I understand.
yeah, so she the Federal Trade Commission polices monopoly in America, except for meatpacking. So USDA oversees the meat markets from a monopoly standpoint. And as weird as this sounds, Arnie, it all goes back to chicken, too. So when these regulations were written a century ago after the jungle, chicken wasn't written into the regulations because there was no commercial chicken slaughterhouses. You just had chicken in your backyard and you butchered it. So what happened in the South was corporations took that sharecropping model that exploited black farmers, applied it to chicken, which means it made chicken really cheap, but it's incredibly destructive. Most chicken farmers are in poverty. And then what happened across the food system was this they call it chickenization. It went to other models. Like pork is now chickenized. Berry, Driscoll's is in my book. They sell one of three berries, but they don't grow a single berry because they chickenized. That's why I want to shift this over back over to the Federal Trade Commission because USDA just, it's so incompetent at this job right here.
I'm going to ask you, I'm glad you have this book out, but you've got to sort of break this book down and start writing, whether it's at The Nation magazine, whether it's at Mother Jones, whether it's at Vanity Fair. You have to start chopping this up and holding our hands and explaining it to us. They need to see the connection. You want to redirect the anger? Well, the way you redirect our anger is you sort of look at the silo that you're talking to and saying, this is the cause of this. This is the cause of this. This is how we fix it. So if you have a vision for what the food system should look like. My last words to you, Austin Friedrich. Thank you so much for writing the book, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. If we could fix the system, what would that look like?
The single best thing we can do is put animals back on the land. Ethanol is dying. That's a big priority of the Biden administration to put, cars into electric vehicles. The single largest use of corn now in America is ethanol. That's going to die fast. Take animals out of these metal sheds and put them on land. It's a better tasting product. It's a jobs program for rural America, and it creates more middle class farmers.
Audience, do you realize what he just said? Put the animals back on the land. You probably didn't know they weren't there. You probably didn't know you weren't there. That's why I love you, Austin Friedrich, because
Thanks for having me on, Arnie.
you myth bust for so much that we need to do. Again, Austin Friedrich is a seventh generation Iowan, and he has held his first job since he was 12 years old. He was the first member of his family to go to college. Were we so lucky that he went? And he has just completed a remarkable, remarkable book. Again, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Get him on your radio show, get him to your school, get him to your classroom, read his book. This, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Yesterday, Mike Johnson said it was time to stop lecturing Israel on how to defend itself. Now, we should start with the obvious. Mike Johnson knows nothing about foreign policy. He is a bizarre Christian nationalist who is wildly unfit for high office. But the sentiment he expressed is, while not held by a majority, perhaps, nonetheless widely held. It is also deeply, deeply wrong. The United States is arming Israel, is supplying Israel with weapons, and has been a patron of Israel for decades. It has every right to lecture Israel on how to defend itself. In fact, it has a responsibility to help Israel figure out how to defend itself. And the reason for that is obvious. One reason is that without United States assistance, Israel wouldn't be able to defend itself. So that makes us a participant in this conflict. And the second is that Israel is trying to drag the United States into a broader regional conflict. And the United States has a right and, in fact, a responsibility to try to prevent that from happening. So Mike Johnson, as is so often the case, is absolutely and dangerously wrong in his claim. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my...
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality. For so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war. Where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
This is part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know what we're doing? We're recording on Monday morning, the day of the big total eclipse. Speaking of total eclipse, John Nichols seems to be someone who, when I think about a total eclipse, I think about someone who really has sort of eclipsed the landscape of politics. John Nichols is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He has written and co-written and edited over a dozen books on topics ranging from histories of America to socialism, the Democratic Party. His most recent book that I should have written with them, with Bernie Sanders, is entitled It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. And it turns out that he is speaking at Yale Divinity School today, which is like lovely. Anyway, I was saying to him, I said, so what are you talking about? What will be your warm-up act? And you're talking about sort of religion and politics, and you're talking about the role of media in this. I did not know that I'd be grabbing you, John, and I did not know that that was what you'd be talking about. But today on my Facebook page, I posted a quote by the great Reverend William Sloan Coffin. So no surprise. He has a fabulous quote that I actually need because I want people to remember in November. And here is his quote. The world is too dangerous for anything but truth, and too small for anything but love. The world is too dangerous for anything but truth, and too small for anything but love. And I ask my audience to hold on to that as they think about the election in November of 2024. So let me thank you again for joining me, and let's talk a little bit about what's going on, because about religion and politics and the media. And in an interesting way, the story that you wrote at The Nation about Gaza and about all the young people now, about 500,000 voters who have expressed disgust and discouragement and looking for ceasefire or uncommitted, the number is growing. And I do need to let you know that New Hampshire being the first in the nation presidential primary, even though the Democrats didn't recognize it, I was one of those people that wrote ceasefire in instead of Joe Biden at the very, very beginning. And I got scolded by everyone. How could you do this? Don't you realize what's going on? And now, a couple of months later, look what we're talking about. And Joe Biden is realizing that the pressure is on because the inhumanity is overwhelming. So welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be with you, Arnie. And no, I think your point is well taken. That's one of the great challenges with what has happened in Gaza. We, as a society, have two discussions, right? We have a discussion that is the political discussion, right? And then we have a discussion which is the moral discussion. And of course, for human beings, for ordinary folks, these things intersect, right? There is a sense that politics should be related to morality. What your values are, what you believe ought to influence how you vote. And yet we have a lot of folks saying, oh no, you shouldn't do that. Don't vote based on your morality. Don't vote based on your belief that it is wrong to kill 33,000 civilians, Palestinian men, women, and children, to destroy,
to starve them. I mean, think about that. We talk about the killing. What we aren't talking about is that famine also kills.
Right, of course, and it does long-term damage, but also to destroy 80-90% of the infrastructure, literally to obliterate a region of the world. And in all of the things that relate to this, there are going to be people who have a moral response to that, right? They're going to say, this has got to stop. I want to use whatever legitimate, peaceful tools I have to stop this horror, which the International Court of Justice says, it brings us to questions of genocide. And so as people go to vote, they are, they're saying, look, I'm going to find a vehicle to communicate my concern. It's democracy embodied. This is the exact right use of democracy. It is
exactly
to tell your leaders what they should do. And yet we have folks saying, oh, well, no. If you vote uncommitted or uninstructed or write in ceasefire or do something like that in a primary to communicate to Joe Biden that he should not continue the policies of the United States as regards Gaza, as regards Israel and Palestine, that he should change course, right? And that change, of course, should begin with stopping the killing of Palestinians, stopping the killing of Israelis. But that should only be the beginning. Once you've stopped the killing, then you flood aid into those who need it. But then also you begin a peace process that sees that you never end up in this place again. I mean, these are all things that I think ordinary people easily figure out. And so we've had a lot of votes now. We've had more than 500,000 people who have cast a vote in some way or another directly saying, we want some kind of ceasefire. We want to stop this thing. Actually, that's a way big underestimate because, as an example, in New York State, you can't vote uncommitted or uninstructed. So in New York State, people just left their ballot blank. There's some estimates that in New York, as many as 10-12% of people left their ballots blank. That's getting into tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people. So the message to Biden is strong. Now, what's wonderful about this is Biden seems to be hearing it. Not perfectly. Not as well as I would hope, not with the immediacy, the urgency that is necessary, but you do see a movement in the administration. So democracy is working. And those who would tell you not to act on your moral impulse, right, would prevent that from happening. And so it's important to understand that acting on your moral impulse, acting on your values is a useful path into politics, right? It's not something that you should dismiss and put aside and only vote, pragmatically, right? Or only vote in a narrow sense of fear of another candidate or something like that. And this, if we begin with this concept, then we can extend out into, this broader question of faith in public life, right? Of where, how our morality influences us. Now, our media is very comfortable with the idea that amorality, whether you agree with it or not, influences people on the Christian right. They are motivated by what they believe. But it almost completely denies and neglects people on a Christian left. What I would argue is, people whose interpretation of the Bible, and remember, it doesn't have to just be the Bible. It can be Quran. It can be Torah, it can be all sorts of religious texts, but people whose interpretation leads them to believe that their vote, their engagement in politics ought to be on behalf of peace and diplomacy, of economic and social and racial justice, of saving the planet, of preventing a climate crisis. This is something that happens all the time. There's a lot of people that are so motivated, but we don't talk about it. We don't cover it. And I think the failure of our media to recognize that, and to recognize, frankly, that we do have a clash. We have a clash of interpretations. When we fail to do that, we warp the debate. And we miss serious revelations. We miss serious moments to have insight. And to give you an example of this, when the Pope spoke to Congress a number of years ago, and he spoke to a joint session of Congress, it was a remarkable moment. And the Pope gave a carefully constructed speech in which he sought to communicate that the United States had a deep, long tradition of, within Catholicism, but beyond Catholicism, of a morally based advocacy for economic justice. He spoke about Dorothy Day. He spoke about Dr. King and others in this context. It was a profoundly wise and seriously constructed speech. And yet our media, at its best, covered the Pope's speech, you know, as, oh, well, here's, you know, this guy from Rome who came in to talk to Congress and wonder what that means for abortion, or wonder what it means for, you know, things like that. And it missed the point. And our media misses the point again and again and again. I think most people are unaware that of all the religious denominations in the United States, the one that is most, you know, proportionally most highly engaged with the Gaza issue at this point, and literally is bringing its members, you know, deeply into the discourse on a daily basis, is the Mennonites. Sure. And there's a group called Mennonite Action. They literally are occupying congressional offices all over the country. Insurance agents, lawyers, farmers. This is a moral duty to stop what is going on in Gaza. Has it been covered? I mean, are we aware of this? That people who, you know, take perhaps as seriously as any denomination issues of war and peace feel that they have a moral duty to get up every morning and try and stop what's going on in Gaza. And the last thing I'll give you, just to close out this, you know, where we miss the story so often. I spent some time recently with Sean Fain, the head of the United Auto Workers.
Right.
And Sean Fain is a deeply religious man. He prays every day. He reads scripture every day. It's a serious big part of his life. And it influences him. It's a part of his language. And, you know, when he goes around the country, he quotes Bible quite often. He quotes scripture quite often. And he's not telling people they have to believe what he believes. He is just simply speaking from where he comes from. Now, there's a lot of media that's trying to figure out why is the UAW doing so very well in the South right now after decades of failure in the South? Why
faith is it- and family, faith and right. family. There you go. There
that's
you
right. go. Sean Fain literally was speaking the other day to Mercedes workers, where they just had a huge breakthrough as regards their effort to get union representation. Mercedes workers in Alabama. And I was listening to the speech and he goes, you know, can we do this? Well, faith, the size of a mustard seed, can move mountains. Well, if you know the parables, if you know the Bible, I mean, this is Jesus talking, this is religious tradition. And you think, well, why is that relevant to covering this story? Well, when you are talking to black and white workers in Alabama and you quote from the Bible and the black worker says, wow, I know that. Yes. And the white worker says, oh, I know that. Yes. Suddenly you have made a connection with workers, right? You have brought people together across lines of race and class and all these divisions. That's powerful stuff. And we ought to be writing about Sean Fain in that context, right? We ought to be communicating to people. That's a part of why what he is doing is working.
So we were talking about faith. So we interviewed a woman named Audra Watkins. And Audra Watkins writes about Project 2025. And what did she write about Project 2025? She comes from that fundamentalist Christian evangelical family. Okay, that's where she comes from. And she eventually was able to pull herself out. But she started reading that 900-page tome put out by the Heritage Foundation about their plans for leadership and what they're planning on doing and their sort of fascist agenda. And she reads it through the lens of Bible verse.
Mm-hmm.
Bible verse. And she literally pulls out sections and says, look at these words and where do they come from? This is their justification for what they're about to do, which is dismantle everything. Okay. And basically sort of support this concept of a white Christian nation. But I'm going to challenge you on this. And I want you to say this at Yale Divinity School.
Yeah.
So when you and I travel around the Midwest and we turn on the radio, Rush is dead, but when I used to be there, there was only two things I heard on the radio. I heard Rush Limbaugh on virtually every station I turned to, and then I heard Christian radio 99% of the time, everywhere. I don't care how big the station was. I don't care where. And my question to the more liberal members of the church, where were they? Why weren't they on the radio? Why weren't they connecting the dots? Why weren't they talking about the fact that a budget, a state budget, a federal budget, or whatever, is a moral document?
Mm-hmm.
It is not just about dollars and cents. It's not. It shouldn't be driven by Wall Street. It should be driven by you. So part of the problem is not only has the media not been able to understand how to cover the more progressive liberal members of the clergy, but they also abandon people. What the evangelicals understood was that they needed to communicate not just on Sunday, but every day. And the best way to do it was to be on the dial. What happened to us?
Well, here's an interesting answer to your question. When you talk about us, right?
Well, I mean the more liberal.
Right, there are different interpretations, and people can read the Bible as they choose, and people have throughout history. And I think this is important to understand. There's always going to be a discourse there, a dialectic. But here's one of the subtleties of it, Arnie. When you travel in some parts of America, you are right, and I've done it. I've hit the button, and it just runs through the dial, and it catches whatever comes up. And often it is a Christian radio station, and often in Kansas or in Oklahoma, it is a Christian, very conservative, very fundamentalist message. I've also hit the dial driving through Mississippi, and I have heard Black Christian radio in Mississippi, which is often very progressive, very redemptive, right? It is an alternative message. And one thing that I think is important to understand is that when we talk about Christianity, right, when we talk about it, one of the big mistakes we make is to assume it's white, right? And it is true that there is a white Christian nationalism that a lot of people are writing about, a lot of people have interpreted. And some of that has roots going back to the founding of the country, right? This is not a new phenomenon, not a new purpose of saying, you know, look, this is a city on a hill for us, right? Not for them, you know, this divisive approach. But it is also vital to understand that there is a Christianity that has historically been very progressive and very challenging in power, and that, in fact, has communicated on a lot of platforms, in a lot of levels. It is the Black church, right? And I would ask you, think with me about where faith has intersected with politics in the last 100 years and where it has had an absolutely profound impact. I would suggest the civil rights movement, right?
Civil rights,
rooted in faith, rooted in Christian faith, but also inviting, welcoming, being in coalition with Jewish, Muslim, and people who are non-believers, right? This kind of broad coalition, but with a lot of faith inputs on it. And I think that what has to happen now is for our media, again, I come back to that media issue, to understand the fullness of faith, right? To understand that there are many, many aspects of it that they don't cover. And it is no secret that our media has historically done an awful job of covering the Black community, right? Neglectful, dismissive, stereotyped, et cetera, et cetera. And as such, we have in a discussion about religion and politics, we've often taken one of the most dynamic forces in religion and politics out of the mix. It's not something we talk about. And the last thing I'd say on that, why it's very important, is that, again, when we talked about that Sean Fain example, right? Sean Fain knows that. And so when he speaks, from a biblically based, scripture based, a religious standpoint to a crowd in Tennessee or to a crowd in Alabama, they hear something that makes sense to them, right?
Yeah.
And it makes connections, and it is powerful politically. If you don't understand why that makes sense and why it makes connections and why it is powerful politically, you are missing like a new iteration of faith in politics, right? And I will tell you, early on, did the media miss civil rights? It absolutely did. The media wasn't there in the 30s and 40s in the way that it should have been. In the late 50s, after the Montgomery bus boycott, things of that nature, you started to have media, New York Times and others say, wow, we ought to send correspondents to the South. We ought to start covering this in a serious way. When they did, huge changes occurred, right? Because media does create our narrative in our country. Well, what I'm suggesting to you now is that our media system does a lousy job of covering the fullness of engagement. I'm not saying that you shouldn't cover Christian nationalists.
John, while you were talking, I Googled the two words, faith and family. Can I tell you what first comes up? Let me just share on Google. Texas GOP stands for strong faith and family. That's great. The first thing that comes up. And so part of me is so angry about that. Yep. They now own words. They own the concept of faith. They own the concept of family. They own the concept. When you say the word life, immediately someone thinks pro-life and thinks Republicans.
Yeah.
It's like, it is so sad. And what I love about your story about Sean Fain is that he actually adds a third dynamic to the word, another F word. And you know what it is? It's faith. It's family. And here's the third F word, fairness.
Yes.
Fairness. Yeah. And that's where I think we can take those words back, because we add the third F. And when you don't add the third F, then they control the definition of my faith, not your faith, of the family I want to control, not your family. And by putting in the third F, the fairness piece, you've changed the whole lens through which you look at both faith and family, because in a way, then Sean Fain becomes the amazing leader. Because he is the trifecta. He is all those things.
You're correct. And that's why I bring it up as an example. But that's why I also bring up Mennonite Action, right?
Yes.
You know, and why there are so many examples. Look, one of the people I always point to when we talk about things like this is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who is Muslim. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a great sports figure, he brings his faith into all kinds of public life. And doesn't try to, you know, force anything on anybody, doesn't try to push it, but it influences who he is in public life. It is profound. He is not the only person that I would point to in this regard. I can find a lot of people. I always use an example. This is one of my ones that I cite quite often. About a dozen years ago, there was an attack on a Sikh temple in Milwaukee. It was a horrible, horrible attack. Guy went in and shot all sorts of people. And he was a right winger, and he was so ignorant. He thought he was shooting Muslims, or he thought he was shooting, you know, there was some lack of clarity about, you know, whether he even knew who he was attacking, but he attacked Sikhs. And of course, this is a huge issue. Every media came rushing to this site. There was, you know, it was a scene of police and everything outside. And immediately the Sikhs of the temple, the people who were literally a part of it, not folks who'd come in to help, but people who were of the temple, were setting up tables out front. And, you know, bringing food, soup and other things and water and everything and serving the journalists and everybody else, the police and everybody there. And folks were going, you know, what's going on here? Shouldn't you be, you know, in mourning? Shouldn't you be in horror? Shouldn't you be angry and enraged? Shouldn't you be all these other things? And they would say, no, our faith tradition requires us to serve and to welcome those who come to our temple, even in a moment of horror. And it required everyone to kind of, a lot of people to stop and go, oh my goodness, I guess I didn't really fully, you know, we wanted to see this as one thing, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to see this as another tragedy of gun violence, which is totally legitimate to do. But what we're missing is that there are people who respond even to the worst of tragedies rooted in their religion,
tradition.
Rooted in their faith, rooted in what their faith requires of them. And so the Sikhs served people who came to cover their tragedy. The Mennonites go each day to congressional offices to try and demand an end to violence in Gaza. Sean Fain speaks about economic justice, yes, from a standpoint of biblical traditions and things that are said in the Bible about wealth and poverty and about a duty to the poor. And when you start to recognize this, right, you do a better journalism. Your journalism is truer and it gets closer to reality. When you fail to recognize this, right, then things all seem isolated and hard to explain, maybe even a little strange. And so what I'm suggesting is simply that at this point in this deeply divided country with all of our challenges, we frankly need a much, much deeper and better coverage of faith in public life.
Well, and again, I'm going to remind everyone, I Googled faith and family, and what comes up? Texas GOP stands strong for faith and family. I don't want that to be my first thing in a Google search.
No, well,
that's the failure of the media. You know that, and I know that.
I do, yeah. But it's nothing against the Texas GOP, by the way, right?
No, no.
The Texas GOP has its right to go where it chooses to go. But what I would remind you is, right,
that it becomes their slogan. It becomes their slogan.
They shouldn't own that.
That to me is hard. Yes.
They should not have ownership of it. And who gives them ownership of it? The media does, right? Our media says, oh, well, we're going to give you that. Now, what's interesting about it is, why wouldn't our media, right, say, no, you know what? Actually, you know, this deep faith, boy, if we're going to be assigning, you know, responsibilities, why not assign to these other folks I'm talking about? Why not assign it to Eugene Victor Debs and the Socialist Party of 100 years ago? Because Debs constantly quoted from the Bible. Debs constantly quoted from religious tradition and spoke from scripture as a socialist. And in fact, he made it very clear that his socialism was rooted in his faith, right? And if I said to you, well, then I guess we should say that you know, Debs is has you know, ownership, quote unquote, of faith and family of these things. Well, somebody would say to me, well, that's absurd. He's a socialist, right? You can't have that. What I would just tell you is that this is where the challenge comes in. Right? We have to go deeper and we have to recognize that faith influences all sorts of people on the left and on the right. It gives us common language quite often, but not necessarily common interpretation. And so this is a real debate, right? And it's an honest and a fair debate. It's okay to do it. But when you neglect half of that debate, or more than half of that debate, when you don't see that side of it, because our media, I think, tends to think that the left is secular, right? Then you lose sight of what is frankly motivating a lot of people.
I mentioned Gaza, and you have the most recent article, you're talking about the uncommitted and how they're sending a message to Joe Biden, and the numbers are huge, and we're actually seeing that Joe always had the power. He claimed he could not influence Bibi Netanyahu, but we now see that he can.
Yes.
Because no sooner did he basically threaten to sort of pull back on some of the military support than what did Bibi do? He opened up, Netanyahu opened up a pathway, I believe, into northern Gaza. I mean, so we know actions have consequences, and Joe had the power. He chose not to use it for far too long. Too many people died because he chose not to do that. But it isn't just a question of morality. So when I talk about Gaza and I talk about the morality and you talk about sort of the religious tenets that underpin that, but then I'm accused of being an anti-Semite, which also has a religious tenor to it. So how do we talk about this idea of morality without being accused of somehow your morality places blame on another faith, as if that's a choice between faiths, as between a choice of making a horrific policy decision? I keep saying over and over again, Israel is not a synagogue. Israel is a nation. Israel is not a synagogue. And therefore, the prime minister is not acting as the rabbi. He is acting as a bad political leader, making bad decisions. This is not a religious conversation. This is a political conversation.
So, Arnie, this has always happened, though, right, throughout history, right? We have literally, from the same book, from the same religious tradition, the same scriptures, we've taken different interpretations and accused someone of something else, or tried to justify something horrible based in scripture. This has always happened. It is the history of the world. So,
and on that note of the history of the world, John Nichols, I have to let you go. I cannot believe it. We need an hour with John Nichols. John Nichols is joining us. He's actually be speaking today at Yale Divinity School. He is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. Thank you so much for doing this. And we need more time. But then again, at least we have some time. So take care, John.
I appreciate it.
All right, everyone. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. We will schmooze tomorrow. Change.